So if you have your handout, I'll give you the first three points that we covered last week. We're talking about budgeting, spending, and debt. And last week we talked mostly about the budget, and then tonight we're going to turn on to the next point to talk about debt. So we had number one, and did anybody bring their notes from last week? Anybody remember what's number one? A budget doesn't work without planning, okay? And then number two, we talked about the categories of a healthy budget, the main categories of a healthy budget, and went over all of those. And then does anybody remember what was number three? What is a terrible example of how to run a budget? The United States government. Thank you very much. Ronnie and I were laughing when in the afternoon sermon, Brother Knickerbocker said, if you ran your budget at home like they run their budget in D.C., you would be in jail. So we were laughing about that because we didn't talk about it, but that's kind of exactly what we were covering last week. So what I wanted to do is review a little bit of what I ended last week talking about and then move on to the next point. And sometimes I get to the material I have, I say it through really fast, and then I think, well, let me see, did I give all of the context to what I was wanting to? What we talked about, the United States government being a terrible example of a way to run a budget, and we said that over two-thirds of what the government spends is either entitlement programs or interest on the debt. So we're going, we gave the numbers last week, about $34 trillion. James and I were talking about that, a way to help us try and understand what a trillion is. I think it's a million different times. The government is currently in debt, $34.75 trillion. If you want something that makes you nervous, you can go to the website where they show the debt clock, and every second it keeps going up and up based off of our projected debt on the current rate of spending. So the main thing is that they're not running the budget according to sound biblical principles, because it's not the worst thing to have a program to want to help people who need help or try and encourage people to save for when they're old and have a program like Social Security where we would try to make people aware and say, hey, when you get old, you're going to need help, so you need to set some money aside. But what I didn't mention last week is that the poverty rate in every single category where the government has tried to make a program to help, all of these programs that have put us trillions of dollars in debt, does anybody want to take a guess? Since the day they were instituted, have those problems gotten better or have they gotten worse? They've gotten far worse. Because we have a society that slides away from God and living by biblical principles, and maybe in the early days in the United States of America, say you had a farmer who fell out of a tree and broke his leg. Well, if he was living in community and a local church and everybody knew each other and were living according to Christian principles, you might have had the whole town and all the people surrounding him show up to help harvest his crop because his leg was broken. But where we are is we're trying to put a government program for everything and spend. And all that's happened is that in every single one of those categories, the numbers have gotten worse and worse and worse. The amount of people that are in poverty, the amount of people that need help, that are on welfare, those things get worse and worse. So the basic thing I said last week is I think that the United States government would do well to phase out the entitlement programs and then stop spending money they don't have, which is what we're going to talk about tonight. If we want to have a healthy budget, we can't spend money that we don't have by shifting it around through debt and interest payments, or eventually it really will catch up with us. So sometimes you talk about those things like entitlement programs or government spending, and people want to say, well, you don't want to help people. You're someone who's heartless. You think the government should let people die in the streets. It's not that we want people dying in the streets. It's that the government is usually a pretty horrible solution for someone to entrust with one running a program to help those people. And the way that the United States government has been running their budget based off of promising people, well, vote for me and I'll give you free stuff, and borrowing money to pay for it, has set us up where we're in a tough spot with inflation and the future doesn't look great. There will be consequences to pay if they don't start applying simple biblical principles, which again would be don't spend money you don't have, don't borrow money to pay for programs to try and buy people's votes. And we said last week, well, what's the real problem and what's the solution? It's a lack of character by everybody involved, most of all the populace, who keeps voting for people who's promising to give them free stuff or to take stuff from other people and give it to them. both parties have been very bad in spending, and whether it's the Republicans or Democrats in control in recent decades, the spending, the deficits, and the debt continue to rise and rise and rise. And when they simply print money in order to blow it into the economy and make people feel at ease and give them money in their pocket with stimulus checks, what they do is they devalue the dollars that are currently in circulation by just printing dollars that don't exist, that aren't backed by actual assets, and it makes your money worthless. So worth less and less. So we said last week, people get excited. They gave me a $1,200 stimulus check. But then a few months later, now your burger costs an extra $3 than it cost before. And it's directly tied to the principle of supply and demand. It's really only sixth grade economics, where if the government would run a sound budget, then everything would be a lot better in the long run, even though it would be harder for them to try and buy votes in the short term. And just this last week, I think the White House proposed that they were going to do rent control, which means they would make a law saying if you're a landlord, you can't raise people's rent. And again, that sounds good to people, but if you look up the history of it, where they practiced that in New York City and other places, the people who own the buildings stop maintaining the buildings. They stop building new buildings because they can't make as much of a profit. And some people even burn their buildings to the ground for the insurance money. And if you watch old movies set in New York City, every now and then what they'll talk about, the characters going around, is they can't find a room to rent. So they say, okay, we'll do rent control. We'll have the government say, you can't set rent any higher than this. And the people who own the buildings who need to make money, they stop building new buildings. And then there's a housing shortage where people can't even find a room to rent. So all of that to say, that's on a national level. Now, what we can do is we can vote, but all things considered, our one little vote in the future, if we think about it that way, there's not a whole lot we can do to control what the government does or what's going on in the White House. But what we can control is our house and how we handle our money. So if we wait around for the government to fix our life or to make things better, that's going to be a long wait. But what we can do is say whatever the future looks like, whatever economic crashes and recessions may come, if I set my house in order while I'm able to, then I can run my household based off of sound biblical principles and not have to be so worried about what the government is doing. So we'll jump to number four in the outline, which I think will be on page two of your handout. And number four, we'll consider debt is a severe hindrance to a healthy budget. Debt is a severe hindrance to a healthy budget. So let me say this tonight. I said in the very first week of the study that talking about finances can almost be like talking about our weight or health or fitness. We talk about, if we start talking about how to do better, some of us might feel bad that we're not doing better than we are. So what I like about the way things are around here is that I don't know your financial situation. By and large, I don't know how you're running your budget because I don't try to control people's lives. If someone has a practical question they want to ask, I can try to help them. But I've heard of church structures where it's set up so legalistic and top heavy that the pastor demands you come get my permission before you buy a car, or you have to get my permission before you sell your house. That's obviously not biblical. That's not the role that God gave pastors to do. And the other reason I don't like that is I don't want to tell you if you're allowed to buy a car or buy a house because I don't know everything. And I might tell you wrong and then you can come back and get mad at me later. Now, if I tell you what the Bible says, then I know that I'm standing on good ground and authority because I'm just telling you what God said, and what you do with it is up to you. So what we're going to do tonight is we're going to look at biblical principles and then we're going to talk about practical applications. Now, practical applications and even biblical principles are not on the same level as Bible doctrine, okay? So Jesus is the Son of God. Jesus is the only way to heaven. If you disagree with that and you try to spread something different around the church, then we've got a big problem and we're going to have to earnestly contend for the faith. But if I give biblical principles about budget and debt, and you look at it and think, well, I'm going to run my budget slightly different than Pastor Jack does his, that's okay. So I don't know your situation. I'm not trying to stir up things that would make you feel bad if you have debt in your life that you want to get rid of or decisions you've already made. But what I want to do is help you and just give you something to think about. And we're always talking about the future and decisions that are to be made, because decisions in the past are in the past. So just let me get through this here tonight. We'll see if we have questions at the end. And again, I'm not talking about you, because I don't know what your situation is. So if there's something that makes you feel like you wish you've done better or feel like you're getting picked on, that's not the intent. I just want to be a help and a blessing. And I'm going to give scriptures, and then we'll talk about some applications about them. Okay, so let's look through some scriptures about debt pretty quickly here. In the book of Exodus, it says, if a man borrow aught of his neighbor, and it be hurt or die, the owner thereof not being with it, he shall surely make it good. Now, this is a very interesting verse, and here's what it's saying. It's saying, if I go to Santiago and say, I need to borrow your oxen because mine is sick, or I ran out of money and couldn't buy one, or it died, I need to borrow a couple of your oxen so that they can pull my plow and I can harvest my crop. If I borrowed it and the ox gets hurt or dies while it's in my possession, what does this verse tell me I have to do? I have to make it right. It's saying the owner not being with it, you shall make it good. It's saying it wouldn't be fair for you to borrow something from somebody else, destroy it, and then not give restitution. So that was a practical application in the law of God about a caution about borrowing something that's not yours. But the verse also shows us that there's an innate risk. And what do I want to say? Something that's not totally comfortable or sure when we borrow something from somebody else. Now, if I have a chainsaw and you don't have a chainsaw, and you come ask me and say, can I use your chainsaw? I think it would be a good Christian thing for me to do, if I know you, I trust you, to say, here, take the chainsaw, use it, and give it back when you're done. But when I lend it out, I need to realize I'm not in control of whether or not it comes back to me. So from the lender's side, I think if you're going to let people borrow your stuff, what you need to do is understand that something could happen to it. And if it does, you're not going to get bitter at your friend because maybe the chainsaw broke and they ended up not making it right. I agreed to take that risk when I lent it to you. But from your perspective, if you borrowed it from me and it breaks, your desire should say, well, let me make it right. So there's a little bit more of a risk when somebody's borrowing something from one of their friends. First of all, you're risking that it could break and you'd have to go buy them something to make it right. Or you're risking that you might not be able to make it right and you could hurt the friendship because now you're trading things back and forth. Okay? So freely give, but when you borrow something, realize it's going to be your responsibility to give it back. Now, we can apply this to money and say that when we borrow money that's not ours, we have a moral responsibility to pay it back. And there comes a risk with that, that something could go wrong and it could be more difficult to pay the money back at a later time. A couple more verses. Psalm 37:21. The wicked borroweth and payeth not again, but the righteous showeth mercy and giveth. Another one in Deuteronomy. For the Lord thy God bless thee as he promised thee, and thou shalt lend unto many nations, but thou shalt not borrow. And thou shalt reign over many nations, but they shall not reign over thee. So Psalm 37:21 was saying the wicked borrows, but has no intention to pay it back. But the righteous don't behave that way. Then Deuteronomy 15:6 and also Deuteronomy 28:12 are saying that as God looks at the future of the nation of Israel, he says, I'm going to bless you. The Lord shall open unto thee his good treasure, the heaven to give the rain unto thy land and his season, and to bless all the work of thine hand. So God says, I'm going to bless you. Then he says, and thou shalt lend unto many nations, and thou shalt not borrow. So it would be a sign of their prosperity that if there was to be a borrowing and a lending aspect, the nation of Israel would be blessed and they wouldn't need to borrow other people's money because they would have plenty. But maybe there would be people who would come ask the nation of Israel, can we borrow your money? Now, as we'll see from a moment in the book of Proverbs, when one is lending and one is borrowing, the one who has borrowed is in a position where he is beholden to the one who has lent him the money, and he's kind of under the thumb of that person until he pays back all of the money and he doesn't owe anything anymore. It's in a more spiritual context, I think, but Romans 13:8 says, owe no man anything but to love one another, for he that loveth another hath fulfilled the law. And then a key one is Proverbs 22:7. The rich ruleth over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. So the book of Proverbs is a genre, a category of scripture that's sort of all by itself. It's talking about literal things. It's talking about practical things, very practical wisdom. And that's why every single week we have verses in here about money from the book of Proverbs, because it's jammed full with practical wisdom of how to live your life. And if you want to live your life with practical wisdom, what's one thing you need to be wise about? Money. So God gives us direction. So a proverb is, it's like a truth. It's very much a general truth that proves itself over time. And the proverb and the principle here is that the rich rules over the poor person, and the person who is borrowing is servant to the one who is lending them the money. So let's look at some slides and talk about some different ways that Americans have sort of accepted living with a lot of debt, and how that puts a strain on our budget. And as I opened with saying, again, I don't know your situation. It's not about you. It's just trying to be a help. So one thing that is very prevalent is car debt. The cars we drive, where a lot of people kind of accept that in order to get around from point A to point B, you're always going to have a car loan and be paying payments where over time you pay a lot of interest. According to Bankrate, which is just one of those finance websites, a new car loses 15 to 20% of its value the moment it's driven off the lot. So even if you want to get a really nice car, and even if you're going to get a car payment, it's practically speaking not a good investment to get a brand new car right off the lot that's never been driven before. I believe the term they would use is gently used. So if you want like a really, really good car, you probably would do better to hunt around and try to find one that's like a year old with 10,000 miles on it than you would a brand new one. Because again, you drive it off the lot, you come back, you go home, you come back the next day and ask them to trade it in or whatever, it's going to be worth about 20% less than it was the day you bought it, just because you bought it. They also say that a new car will lose 60% of its value in the first 5 years you own it. So we'll talk more about this with investment, but over time, the S&P 500, which is similar to an index fund, it's something in the stock market you can invest in. Over time, it's averaged since its inception right about 10% of a return rate. Has anybody ever played around with a compound interest calculator? We'll talk about it when we talk about investing in a future lesson. But take whatever your car payment is, which I have in here in a moment. I think the average is somewhere around $600, $630. Go home and say between now and age 70, if I took whatever my current car payment is and invested it, and it got 10% compound interest, how much money would I have? That's a fun project. Just go home and do that. And again, we'll talk about it when we talk about investing. But over a lifetime, if you took what it required to keep up with a new car payment and invested it at somewhere around 8 to 12% return rate, it's actually millions and millions of dollars that would be yours at the end of your life. Again, doesn't factor in that you still have a car cost, no matter what you do. But my point being, if we're able to drive a car that we own and free up money in our budget, there's a lot of other things we could do with that money than paying interest to the finance company who made us a loan so that we could buy a nice car. I put this up here. Again, this may just be my opinion, but I think it's practically wise. Always having a car payment is not a great plan. Whether you have one now or for a while if your plan for the rest of your life is I'm going to have a car payment, I'm going to get done with this note or near the end, and I know I'm upside down in equity anyway, so I'll roll it into a new note, and the rest of your life between now and when they take away your driver's license because you're too old to drive, you're going to have a car payment. That's really not a great plan over time. So what is a good plan, in my opinion anyways? If you have a car note, work towards paying it off so that you own it completely. If you're way upside down, you can try to downsize or go to a lesser vehicle. I'm no finance expert. I've been blessed in my life in many ways. One of those ways is just that I lived at home for quite a while after high school. I didn't go to college, but I was working heavy load at the post office. As soon as I graduated, my bills were low, so I had a chance to stay at home without many bills and to save up some money, as well as pay my parents' modest rent. So that worked out great for me. But I bought three cars in my life, and I don't drive a lot of miles. So that's one thing, again, you have to factor in, where sometimes you're like, oh, buy a cheap car. And we have something in our brain that says, but I have kids and they need to be safe. I need to drive a lot of miles. And those things can be true, but the general principle can still be true, that finding a way to not always be paying a finance company interest on our car payment is a really good idea. So my first car that I bought after I've been working for a couple of years and driving my dad's car, I bought a 1993 Cadillac DeVille. Still my favorite car that I've ever owned. It was big as a boat. It was made out of steel. It got terrible gas mileage, but I liked the way it cruised down the road. And I was thinking about it today, and I actually think it was about $2,700 I paid for it. If it was over $3,000, it was barely, but I was able to save my money and pay cash. And I drove that car for about 3 years, didn't have many miles put on it. And then the other two I bought, I think, was a 2001 Ford Mustang that I paid cash for about $5,000, $5,300. And then my old dented up truck right now that I'm still driving, I bought for about $7,000. And I was able to not borrow money on any of those. So a lot of things I want to say, but it's kind of an American thing to do where we think, I can't come up with $8,000 to buy a dependable car or $12,000 to buy a dependable used car. I just can't come up with the money, but I can afford the payment. So I'll buy a $38,000 car instead of an $8,000 car because I can't afford the $8,000 car. And one thing you can do is, again, how tight is your budget? How many miles do you have to drive? There's a lot of considerations there. But one thing I did was I went to John, my little brother, who really knew a lot about cars, and I had him help me look at them. And I did a lot of research seeing which cars, when they get older, does the transmission go out really bad? And which one seemed to last a lot over time? And which one has a good safety rating? So you can go out on a tight budget. Say a single mom is like, well, I only have $3,000. And she goes out and buys a car, and it's what they call a lemon. And it's a nightmare. And she doesn't know anybody that works on cars who's honest. So you go down to the shop. And what does the shop do? Well, we were driving in the country, coming back late one night, and I was driving Melissa's car, the Toyota. I wasn't paying as much attention as I should because I was trying to do the GPS, and I drove off like a little bit of a ditch for a second, and the tire popped. So we changed the tire on the side of the road. It wasn't maybe as efficient as some people, but we still got through it. So I felt manly that I was able to change out the spare and drive it all the way back home. So we got a new tire put on it. And then Melissa said, well, I'm worried about the alignment being all messed up. So she took it to a shop down the road and they said, oh yeah, it's all messed up. It's going to be $3,700 to fix it. And I said, I wouldn't have taken it to that place in the first place. I didn't know you were going this morning. I said, tell him your husband said, we'll have to figure out what we're going to do and then take it to this place down the road. Well, the other place down the road looked at it and said, you're fine. You don't even need an alignment. You don't need anything changed at all. And we've been driving it ever since. The other thing that happened with the Toyota, I'm sorry, if y'all are bored, this is just understand, this is not the normal mode of preaching, okay? Cut me some slack. We're going straight through books of the Bible basically all the time. This is very topical in nature, but just ways to get us to help and think and understand based off of a biblical principle, which is a little bit different than I would like to do in most of my preaching most of the time. So the low oil pressure light went off in the Toyota. We took it down the road. They said, your transmission is shot. We call junkyards. You can either get a transmission that is like medium quality for $3,000 or a good one for like $6,000. Well, I had John, who was working for a Christian man who's a mechanic, help me come get the car and take it to him. And he said, there's nothing wrong with your transmission. I cleaned out the oil filter. I'll charge you $150 for what I changed out. So I called back the other place and I said, so did you like dismantle the transmission to come to that conclusion? And they're like, no, we just looked at the top and saw some junk and thought it probably was shot. So, okay, that's one thing. So say a single mom buys a $2,000 van. It's a lemon. She puts $12,000 into repairing it. They lie to her. It never runs right. She could go, what? I'm done with this. I'm getting a brand new car because that's the only way to be safe. But that might not be the only option if you're able to get people to help you and apply some wisdom, where a lot of the times your kids could be safe, or you could get to work and back if you weren't financing a car that would eat up a giant chunk of your budget. So what could you do? You could pray for God, to ask God for wisdom. But first of all, you could buy a used car. Even if you're getting a note and it's a couple years old, it's going to be a lot cheaper than if you bought a brand new car. You could pray and try to get to the place where you own them outright, whether that's paying cash up front, or whether you look at your vehicle and say, I could pay it off if I make extra payments and focus, and then go back and run the numbers in your budget. If you never have a car payment, you're going to have more margins to be healthy and do other things we want to do. So again, all this is just talking about debt and how the Bible says when you do borrow money, you're in a position where you're sort of in the servant position to the one who loaned you the money until you're able to pay it off. Then you're free again as far as that goes. The average monthly car payment in the United States is $630. After just 12 months of paying $630, how much money is that? I just want to see if Andrew can do it, because when he called that out during church Sunday afternoon, that was really interesting. No, I'll tell you, it's $7,500 if my calculator was right, because I'm not very good at math, but I know where the calculator is on my phone. So $7,500 would actually buy you a pretty usable car if you did your homework. After just 1 year worth of what those payments were to the bank, where a lot of interest is built in and where you're going to have to keep paying them that money, if you paid yourself that while finding a way to get around for a year, you could pay $7,500 cash. So what can you do to move up in car if you don't want a car payment? You can buy a modest car for cash and then save up. And then say it took you half a year, but you saved another $5,000. Now you can sell the used car and put it with your cash, and you can pay cash for a nicer vehicle, and you could keep doing that over and over again, and you move up in the quality of car you drive proportional to how much money you save. There's another product that's called a car lease. A car lease is exactly what it means. You're renting it. Just like you would go back in the day, if you're old enough like me, you could go to Blockbuster and rent a movie. You use it and then you give it back. So when you lease a car, you're renting a car and you sign a contract that from anywhere to 2 to 5 years, you will rent the car from the finance company, from the motor company. And when you hit the end of the lease, you turn the car in. And you don't keep the car, and you don't get any equity from the amount of times you lease the car. So the average monthly car lease in America is $600 a month. The average term is 36 months. So at the end of that 3-year term, you would have paid $21,600 to rent the car, and you wouldn't have any equity. So say you bought a $21,000 car and paid down even with some interest, at least when you got down to the end of that, you would own a car of some value. So car lease is really not a great financial decision unless you've got a whole lot of money and you just want to figure out something to do with it because you have a lot. Okay, here's another thing that, again, I don't know anybody's situation one way or another, but another thing that currently is hurting a lot of people's budgets because of debt is student loan payments. 43.5 million Americans currently have student loan payments. The amount of money that's been borrowed by people to go to college is over $1.7 trillion. And 10% of people who did take out a student loan to go to college owe over $100,000 that they have to pay back because of their college degree. Now, 45% of the people in student loan debt owe less than $20,000, but that leaves the entire middle somewhere between $20,000 and $100,000 when you're already graduated from college with a payment plan where you have to pay it back until you've repaid with interest the money that the bank loaned you to pay the college so that you could get your college degree. There have also been a lot of horror stories of people who took out massive student loans with the intention to do something specific that didn't end up doing what they started out with. Because you're 18, you're 19, you're 20, you think you know what you want to do. But sometimes you get older, you get involved in what you want to do, and all of a sudden you realize maybe that wasn't the future you actually wanted. So what did we say debt does? It increases risk. It increases risk. So I heard a call from one person who went all on student loans to be a doctor, made it all the way through medical school, and then had to take his exams, and he failed. And whether they give you two, three tries, eventually, if you can't pass the test, they say, look, buddy, you probably don't need to be cutting somebody open and performing surgery. You can't be a doctor. But guess what he still had to do with the rest of his life after a 12-year investment? He had to figure out what he was going to do, and he had to pay back an exorbitant amount of money because he had borrowed all of it. Many people got student loans and then didn't get a job that was correlated to it. Here's the other thing that people do is they go to state schools or expensive schools because that's where grandpa went, because that's where my parents went. And if I go to Texas State or to Arkansas or whatever, on the high end, Yale or Harvard, you could end up spending a whole lot more for the same degree you could have gotten if you had went 2 years to community college and 2 years to a more modest college and lived at home instead of the dorms and worked all of the time and went maybe a little bit slower instead of being a full-time student. You know what they say? I don't have the number in front of me, but the amount of hours that students at State University end up giving to drinking and partying every single week is astounding. So they go to class and then they drink and they party when maybe they could have gone to a smaller college and worked really hard and not had to pay quite so much to get their college education. Now, what we currently hear from a lot of the populace in America and the politicians is that we need student loan forgiveness. Now, if the government comes out tomorrow and says, we're forgiving everybody's student loans, and I hear that you had a student loan that got forgiven, I'm not going to be bitter at you or mad at you. I'll even be happy for you. But the problem is twofold. In the first place, it's not really moral to say everybody, finance your loan. You go and sign the paperwork. I'll pay this money back. And then the government comes back later and says, no, we'll take care of it. You don't have to pay it back. Then what you have is not really the government paying it back. You have other taxpayers paying it back. Okay, so Ronald Reagan used to say, people say, well, the government will pay for it. And he said, the secret is the government doesn't have any money. It's your money. They take it from you and then they assign it somewhere else. So you might have a plumber who broke his back working 12-hour shifts in an apprenticeship and a community college class and then got his own company. And now he's making $130,000 a year. And the government says, we'll take your taxes and pay for the student loan of this person who went for a degree they're not using, who agreed to pay it back. That's why on a moral level, I really don't support it when you're not requiring people to pay back the commitments they made. Here's the other thing that's absolutely hilarious. The loans are still being made. If this is such a horrible thing that an 18-year-old kid who couldn't get approved for any other loan can automatically get a massive student loan to go to college, and that's a terrible thing and we should forgive his loan, then why are we over here still making the exact same loan to all the new 18-year-old kids who are applying for it? And sadly, I'll get off my soapbox about government in a minute, but sadly, that's what the government usually does is people say it's not fair. There's a lot of waste. We found out this government agency failed. So they say, we'll make a new agency, spend a lot more money, a lot more regulations. And they still keep the old one that failed. So they say, well, let's forgive everybody's loan, but they keep making the loans. They say, well, let's give amnesty to everybody who illegally crossed the border, but they won't actually secure the border before they figure out what to do about the people who came across the border that aren't United States citizens. So what can you do? Some people can skip college. I didn't go to college, but I'm not anti-college. Overall, the statistics are you probably will do better in the long run on the averages if you go to college. So finding a way to pay for it and go to college is a really good thing. There's some of you in the room who couldn't be doing the job you did if you didn't go to college. Now, again, not to put you on the spot, but James, sir, you're a business owner. You're in cybersecurity space. Did you get a degree for that? He did not. But he's able to pay his bills in the cybersecurity space by teaching himself, and I would imagine a lot of hours put into learning what you're actually doing. So there's kind of a movement in America to say, you know, we always ask everybody, did you have a college degree? But maybe we should start by asking them, are you competent? Do you know what you're doing? If so, we can train you if need be. And there's a big move by people, too, again, who are looking at the student loan debt and how it's crippling people and they might not ever pay it back. And they say, well, why, in order to do a certain job, are we making them get a 4-year degree when only 2 years of their studies actually have to do with their field? So that's something you could consider. It could be going to trade school. It could not be going to college. And it doesn't mean you have to be stupid or poor the rest of your life if you don't go to college. But if you're going to go, you could look for scholarships. You could try to reduce the years you spend in school by only getting what is pertinent to your training and your field you're going into. You could try to not get a degree you won't use. Say, let me only pursue this if it's actually going to help me in my future that I believe God has called me to do. And you also could work your way through school. Again, maybe you can't pay cash for any school you want to go to just by a part-time job, but you probably could get a part-time job and still go to school. And if you had parents help you out or whatever, and you didn't have to get a job and could focus on your studies, that's great. But most people who go to school could probably work at the same time, at least in some form or fashion. Okay, here's another one. Credit card debt. The total current credit card debt in the United States of America is $1.12 trillion. And if the commentary I heard was correct, I think it was trending in a fairly good direction before what? Before COVID. Then the government said, everybody stay home. You're not allowed to work. Then people started using their credit cards more. Then the government said, oh, well, we'll help you out. We know we said you're not allowed to work, but we'll send you stimulus money. And they shut down the supply chain, printed money, and people leaned on their credit card debt. And now we're dealing with the inflation from that. And people who swiped their credit card to pay for things during COVID are now having to pay all that money back at an exorbitant interest rate. Okay, anybody have a guess what the current average interest rate is on a credit card? If you pay it back, what's the interest rate they're going to charge you? On a mortgage a few years ago, it was 2.7% at the lowest. Now it's somewhere around 7. Any guesses what a credit card rate is? It's 24. Y'all are both exactly right, according to the research that I pulled for this study. So 24%, let's look at an example. Let's say I really want $10,000. I think I really need $10,000. And I say there's no way I'm going to work for it and save it through extra jobs or selling stuff or whatever. I need $10,000. And there's this really cool company named Visa or MasterCard who sent me something in the mail that said they'll lend me the $10,000 and I'll pay it back over time. Now, most people don't pay the minimum, but let's just take that as an example. If you have a credit card balance of $10,000 and your interest rate is 24% and you made the minimum payment, meaning you paid the interest plus 1% of the balance every single month and paid that $300 every month towards that goal, it will take you 354 months to pay the debt off. And in that time, you will pay $19,332.21, not total, but in interest, in addition to the $10,000 you borrowed in the first place. So now you've taken 354 months to pay it back, and you've paid $30,000 instead of $10,000. This kind of debt is easy to get into, but can be difficult to get out of. There might be an emergency or a reason we think we have to borrow the money, but many times there are other options that we could consider instead of swiping it on a credit card. So I should have done the math on this, but $300 a month, if you pay that for 10 months, that's $3,000. But again, maybe you could sell something, maybe you could pay more than $300 a month, and you could get to that $10,000 level at fairly quickly if you tried really hard and pay cash for whatever it was instead of swiping it on the card and then for months and months and months having it hanging over your head and having to pay it back at an exorbitantly high interest rate. Now, let me see. Again, I think in large part we're in this situation because people aren't really valuing biblical principles. Kids aren't really being taught finance in middle school and high school, which is when they should be introduced to all of these things. And college campuses in America will set up a booth outside of the college class and say, here, if you sign up for this credit card, you get a free t-shirt or you get a credit towards a free pizza. So an 18-year-old kid can sign up for a Visa card, get a free t-shirt, and if he's not really understanding the implications, he can swipe it here, swipe it there, say, well, I can't pay all that back, but I can make the payment. And you make the payment long enough, the interest starts to pile up and pile up. And by the time you figure out what really happened, you're feeling stressed and like you can't breathe. You can't afford the basic elements of your budget because a lot of your money is being siphoned off to pay for money that you borrowed. Okay, one more thing here. Anybody ever heard of a payday loan place or seen the storefront where you drive by and it says payday loan? They exist pretty much as a predatory operation to take advantage of people who feel extremely desperate. And the basics of the way it works, if I'm remembering what I read about it a week and a half ago now when I prepared this, is essentially you say, I need the money, I'm desperate, you loan me the money, and I'll sign paperwork that my next paycheck automatically comes to you at a certain amount, and they garnish your wages until they're able to take what they paid back. Does anybody know or have a guess what is the interest rate on the average payday loan?
20? No, 20? Probably like 30.
What I saw said 400%. Wow. The idea being you're going to pay it back super quickly, so you need the money immediately. And again, if I give any stat, y'all look it up later. Let me know if I was tired late at night and it said 40%. But I'm just trying to pull from you Google and pull a different source or two to see the rate. So what they do is they take advantage of poor people and it turns into an absolute nightmare if you borrowed money not really understanding what the payday loan shark was doing to you. And then they're breathing down your neck, garnishing your wages to try and get it paid back. So what, again, is my opinion, my advice, my counsel, if I want to say that, about debt when we're applying biblical principles? I think the best thing to do would be to avoid debt. Don't borrow the money in the first place. And again, maybe we were in an emergency and we already did it, then what we should do next is try to pay it off. But a lot of times what we think is an emergency, there could be a wiser way to delay something or to wait. And like some of the finance advice shows I'll listen to, they'll call in with a question and the guy will be like, well, there's a hole in the roof and my wife is panicking. So she wants to pay the roofer who gave the first guy who showed up and quoted $20,000 to replace the whole roof. And she'll say, what do you want us to do? Live with water dripping in? And he'll say no. But in the first place, do some Googling. If you don't have any money and you're in debt already, go to Home Depot and buy a tar bucket and get up there and stop the leak. Then start saving money really fast, sell a car, go get another job, do whatever you can do. And then when you're ready to really fix it all the right way, you take 3 quotes or 5 quotes and you don't get ripped off by the guy who came off the street and you didn't research and you just panicked and threw something at it. So a lot of the time there is a better way to pay for something than debt. So my advice would be avoid it if possible, pay it off if you already have it. And sometimes paying it off might mean you have to run like crazy and work like crazy for a short time period so that you can pay it off. I don't think God would probably want any of us to have a goal that for the rest of our life, I'm going to work 80 hours a week. I'm going to have 4 jobs. If I have kids, I'm going to kiss them goodbye in the morning and that's it because I need money. But if you were in an emergency, you probably could work 80 hours a week. And maybe the other spouse could work 20 hours a week taking a phone call from home or something until you got rid of that debt, and then your budget would look more healthy. Again, why do we want a healthy budget? Is it because we're greedy? It's because we want to take care of our family. We want to give to the Lord and the Lord's work. We want to save for a better future. We want to enjoy it. We might want to take $3,700 next year and pay for a vacation in Arkansas rather than pay it back to the credit card company that we already signed up for to buy something back in the past. So let me read this real quick, and then we'll go over that paper we have. And we are just about out of time again. Man, this lesson, I prepared about 9 pages of notes, and I knew it would be the longest to get through. It was the longest to prepare. We've got the whole summer. So if you can't be on the other ones, I hope you go get the audio, and I've got the handouts for any lessons if you want those. But let's read. This again is just sort of a general principle. It's trusting the fact that God is our Lord and Savior, and He will take care of us. And when we feel stressed out and feel like we might need to do something that's not really wise with our money, if we stop and pray, have faith, God can take care of us, and He might be able to lead us through without us going further and further into debt. Psalm 57 through 15. Hear my people, and I will speak, O Israel, and I will testify against thee. I am God, even thy God. I will not reprove thee for thy sacrifices or thy burnt offerings to have been continually before me. I will take no bullocks out of thy house, nor he goats out of thy folds. Now, the context of the verse is he's saying, you're coming to offer the animal sacrifices to me like I commanded you to, but you're not doing it with your heart right with me. And what I really care about is you have a right heart. And what God's essentially saying is, I don't need your animals, I need your heart. I want you to bring the animals to sacrifice to me, but I want that to be because your heart is in the right place. And God will say, I don't need animals. I already own a lot. God doesn't need your money. But God wants you to trust Him by faith that He will take care of you, and understand that if He says, give your money to support the Lord's work or charity or whatever it is, you can trust me and I'll take care of it. And it's not just because I want your money, but I want your heart to be right with me. God says, every beast of the forest is mine, and the cattle upon 1,000 hills. What would it mean if you owned a lot of cattle? I guess today, but especially in biblical times, it would mean you were doing well because you were able to trade in that livestock. You had to have money to own a lot of cattle. But God said, I own the cattle on 1,000 hills. And He owns every beast of the forest. All the fowls of the mountains, the wild beasts of the field are mine. And He owns the hills as well. All creation is God's. If I were hungry, I would not tell thee, for the world is mine and the fullness thereof. So what is God saying? God's saying, I don't really need your animal sacrifices because I'm hungry. I don't really need your money because I'm going to starve without it. I own everything. You can trust me. So get your heart right with me and do with your money what I instruct you to do, and trust that I'm going to take care of you, not that I'm depending on you to take care of me. Okay, does anybody, let's turn to page 3 in the handout. And what we have in page 3 of the handout is questions to ask ourselves before we go into debt. And to encourage class participation, anybody who's willing, let's start with Iman and go this way and work our way back. Let's read them out loud. Iman, would you read number 1?
The saver fears, just to make sure
I'm right. No, it's... Okay, it might be page 4. It says questions to ask yourself before going into debt.
I would need to borrow that. I don't have page 4.
Well, that's ruining my whole plan. I didn't get the handouts right. So what does number 1 say? That's okay.
Do I need it? Am I at peace about this purchase?
Do I need it? Am I at peace about this purchase? In other words, I might be very emotional about something I really want or something I think that I need. How much was it the night they rolled the PlayStation 5s out in the pallets at Walmart? I think it was $1,000 or $1,200, $1,500 when they're hot off the presses. Now, I'm not really a big gamer. I have some, but I'm just saying, if I was you're really into that sort of thing, I might have gone to Walmart and I was going to buy rice and Gatorade. And if I buy rice and Gatorade, that's probably going to run me about $5-$10, depending on how much I get. But I see the PlayStation 5 on the pallet, and my brain convinces myself, I need that. My quality of life is going to be better if I have that. My friends will make fun of me if I don't have that. So what I could do is grab it, go to the front, swipe a credit card, and then be paying it back at 24% interest 20 months down the road on top of other debt I have, because I've got so much I can't keep up. When if I had stopped and said, wait a minute, do I need this? Am I at peace with the fact that I'm borrowing money to buy this? It might have helped. Ronnie, number 2.
Number 2. Is my spouse in agreement?
Is my spouse in agreement? How will it affect my husband, my wife, or my children? Let me think about that before I borrow the money. And next week, I'll come back to that idea of how we're supposed to do finances together in every way when we're married. Andrew, could you read number 3?
Have I compared prices? Will its value rapidly increase or decrease? Does it matter? Can I get along without the bells and whistles? Would a less expensive model do just as well?
Okay, so I said earlier, you have a hole in your roof. Don't just pay the first guy who shows up $12,000 for the whole roof. Be wise about it. Compare. Do your research. And you know when we fail to do that? When we get in a hurry and when it becomes emotional instead of something we planned to do. Who wants to read number 4, Anna or Olivia? Okay.
Will I want this item as much next week, next month, next year as I do today? Delay does not mean denial, but it is a way to see how badly you need something.
So they used to have a program, I don't know if they have it anymore at Walmart, and they called it layaway. Does anybody remember that, know what layaway was? You said, I want this, put it on hold for me, and every week I'll bring you a chunk of the money until I've paid it off, then you give it to me. Now, the day you get it after layaway, you own it 100%. You have no debt. You'll never be paying for it again. It's in your hands. But if you buy it on debt, it's the other way. It's give it to me today. I'll go use it up and have fun. And then by the time I'm tired of it, I'm going to look at my budget and realize I'm still paying it back and with interest. Olivia, number 5. Again, what is a want? What is a need? Is this actually going to help me and others? Or is it something that a commercialism society is saying, you need this to be happy? And that triggers in our brain from commercials, from anything to a new car or to Taco Bell. Our brain says, I need that. And that will make me happy, when that usually isn't the case. David, which one are we on here next? Number 6. Again, say you were going to borrow it. Are you going to pay it back quickly? Have you planned out how long it's actually going to take? Santiago.
Is this affordable in my present financial situation? Am I buying this only because it is on sale, just because it is on sale if I do not need it, or is it not a good deal?
There we go. What do we have right now going on? Amazon Prime Day. Commercials everywhere. So again, you may not have given any thought to the fact that you need a speaker that goes in the shower so you can listen to music while you're taking a shower. But if you see it, you might have the trigger in your brain, I need this, and you might even buy it on a credit card. So a lot of these have to do with going slowly and making a plan, because again, I bet most of our phones in here tonight would have an app that opens Amazon Prime or Walmart or something similar. So you literally could be sitting in the bathroom or at a red light, whip out your phone and buy something. And if you've linked your credit card to it, you might end up financing that Bluetooth speaker at 24%, when if we thought about it, we might have said, let me do without the Bluetooth speaker unless I'm paying cash for it. So Deanne, and then whoever else would like to read the next couple.
Have I considered the cost of owning this after I bought it? Insurance, maintenance, and upkeep can make affordable items unaffordable.
We'll talk about housing next time as well, but we think sometimes, oh, I want to buy a house. I ran the calculator. Maybe it says on paper you can afford it, but you also have housing insurance, you also have property taxes, you also have to fix the roof and the air conditioner and the faucet. You can't just call the landlord and tell him to fix it, so you have to factor that in. Who else wants to read number 9 here? And again, if you don't want to, that's okay. All right.
Will this purchase help me in achieving God's goal for my life? Is there another way this goal can be met?
Again, thinking about on a spiritual level, does this help me on my mission to live for God? And is there another way that this goal can be met if I be patient and pray? Are James and Katie holding babies back there instead of a handout? Okay, I'll read 10 and 11. Number 10, can I easily get out of this debt if I have to? So for example, can I sell the car for as much or more than I owe it at any given time? If not, I will be stuck. I'm wanting to say things, but I know I've got them later in my notes. So let me see. It's 8 o'clock. So I think I'm going to have to pause it. And I'm not even completely done with the debt section, though I'm really close. I think I'll just pick it up there next week. I don't think there's a need to go past 55 minutes of teaching here tonight. But again, come back. Don't say I'm not going to come back, because I don't like the way he's talking about borrowing money. Okay. Number 11, can I wait, save, and pay cash? Impatience has gotten many into debt over what could have been obtained if the person was willing to simply wait until he could afford what he wanted. Now, what's one thing on this list that as I look at it is not there that absolutely should be there? If I'm a Christian, before I borrow money, what should I do first?
Pray
about it. Absolutely. And I, again, Brother Dan Knickerbocker was teaching on Sunday, and we hadn't talked about any of this, but I thought it was just so wise when he said in the afternoon session, I've heard it before, but I hadn't written it down here on any of my papers. Let me write this down here so I know where I'm at. But he said, if you're going to make a major financial decision, who was here? What did he say his dad told him you should do first?
Wait for 30 days.
Pray about it for 30 days and wait. And but if I wait 30 days to borrow this money, I'll never get this deal ever again. Is that true? Very likely not. But is there a good chance you could borrow it immediately without waiting 30 days and later regret it? Yes, there's a much higher chance of that type of a thing. So pray about it and seek God. Okay, so I know we're done. It's 8 o'clock. I haven't brought study questions every week. There's some at the end of this that I think will encourage people talking a little bit whenever we get through this current lesson. So again, keep your hand out if you're coming back next week and bring it back. That'll help us a little bit with printing. But is there anything anyone would like to ask a question or comment or anything really before we dismiss? I would open that up. Yes, sir. Yeah, exactly. How do I open up my own payday loan business? I'll answer simply by saying there's certain businesses Christians should probably not be in. And I would think that would be one of them. God probably wouldn't bless that kind of an endeavor. Isn't that astounding, though? But
yeah,
you hear, you hear the stories later of people. It might have been a single mom who, again, maybe she came from Mexico and she was working and she panicked and she needed the money and she goes in, okay, and then they come after you to try and ruin your life. Because if you're like, they're not going to be like, oh, well, it's okay, you can't pay it back. I mean, we're a charity. No, they're there to cut your throat. That's what it's in business for. So it's very sad. Anybody else? Yes.
I recommend, Pastor, and I don't know if you say this any at all, study simple interest versus compound interest. And I tell you what, if there was ever opportunity for ministry, and if the Lord ever gave me the money to do it, I don't open a bank where you could do simple interest loans and not the evil compounding interest rate. That's, I mean, it's just downright
like flat rate, right?
Immoral. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so compound interest when you're paying it back is horrible. Compound interest when you're earning it from your investments is really good. But what he's talking about, the simple and the compound, you can do all this on a calculator at home. And we may pull some more slides up to show those examples. But it's really just basic math on that. Yeah, and it's sad. Like I said, Christians shouldn't sell meth because it makes a lot of money. There's certain areas where the loaning of money, not in every situation, but the way that it's structured, I wouldn't feel comfortable working for the payday loan guy at the front, much less owning it. So, anybody else? All right, yes, sir.
Stop paying federal income tax.
And then you go to prison. So, first of all, vote to stop paying federal income tax. That would be a great idea if they did that first. Somebody look that up and let me know now or next time, when did they start the federal income tax? It wasn't from the beginning. It used to be a simple tariff or something.
Well,
1913.
Yeah.
So that is a long time before the federal government ever taxed your income. And again, since they said, well, we need to do that, has it gotten better or worse? It's gotten worse and worse and worse. So
1% on the top 1% when
they first rolled it. Yep. So say that again one more time.
It was, I believe, 1% tax on the top 1% earners.
Yep. And principally, they started with that. And look at where we are now. Look at how much of your taxes you're paying into that system when you're nowhere near the top 1% of it.
In the tax code, it says that only federal employees have to pay federal income tax. We opt in. We volunteer to pay it when we sign a W-2.
The only thing I'll say is I know of a guy on the news, say his name, a guy who ran a ministry in Florida in the creation space who took that philosophy And he went to prison for 12 years. So here's what I was going to say. I pretty much agree in philosophy with what the guy in Florida was saying, with what you're saying. And if I ran for office, I would never get elected. But the number one thing I would like to see, other than protection of life and all of that, is a balanced budget amendment where they can't borrow money. The federal government, they can't have an unbalanced budget. They want to pay something, cut it from somewhere else. So if they phased out entitlements and they never borrowed another dime, they never ran another deficit, we'd have a healthy budget and our country would be more blessed. And I think all of that federal stuff is bad, and in principle, I would agree with it. And I'm not saying you're telling everybody here not to pay your taxes, but you take that to the extreme of living it that way, then there's some guy who's called Uncle Sam that comes and gets you. So again, we're sort of in a catch-22 sometimes, where how do I participate in this system in a way that lets me care for my family and be free and serve the Lord, versus what might be right, what might even be ethical, but if I do it, I'm risking them coming after me because I didn't pay their taxes, even though I consider their taxes unjust. Is God holding me responsible because I paid taxes, or am I just doing what I had to do and they're responsible for what they did? Sometimes we got to wrestle through those things, but we got to be wise about it. You know what I mean? Does that make sense? So, gotcha. But I'm with you. I'm a libertarian. We definitely don't need most of what all this. We have philosophy, at least in many different ways. Anybody else? Yes, sir. I don't think you can, which is why we'll talk about housing next week. And again, I put the slide up here. A guy that I recommend is Dave Ramsey. If you're familiar with the name, he says don't ever borrow money except for a house, because a house is an investment. It's a basic need that you have to pay for a place to live either way. And then he has a set of philosophies of how he thinks you should go about it, where still you can borrow house for money in a negative way, or you can do it in a positive way. And so we'll go over all of that. Though before everything went so crazy, there was places in rural Arkansas where if you were making good money and had two jobs, you could pay cash for a $65,000 house. Jason Kirkpatrick bought a house in Allen years and years and years ago, and it was close to that number I just gave you because it was on the highway and it was small. And around here, those things just don't exist, you know. So anyway, a good question, and we'll get back to, I think it's number 6 in this very outline, 5 or 6. We'll talk about housing in depth, but good question. Yes, ma'am.
You can ask Jeff. He'll be able to answer that question.
Okay, all right. That's what I was going to say before. I wish Jeff was here because Jeff, you know, if I get anything wrong, he'll let me know. But anyway, no, I know there's a lot of wisdom from people in the room, which is why I want to give opportunity for questions. And Lord willing, Jeff is actually going to do a lesson before the summer's over, before we get to fall, about his history and business and things he learned from being in those spaces, biblical principles. So anybody else? All right. Well, thank you all for staying. Thank you for your feedback. And let's go ahead and pray and be dismissed with a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, I pray that you would bless everyone here in the room tonight. I pray that as we think about these things, that we would just be able to consider it, and whatever we've done in the past, that we would look to the future to be able to apply biblical wisdom and say, Lord, help me to avoid going into debt and being able to live a life where, by and large, I pay for what I have so that I have more flexibility to care for my family, to give to the Lord's work, and to just enjoy without having to pay it back to other people I'm indebted to. I pray you'd bless our finance study. And as we get through the bulk of this outline, which has most of the practical stuff in it, I just pray that you would help us and help us be able to learn and be good stewards of the stuff you've given us, which is what it's all about. Bless our services we have coming up on Sunday. I pray that all my brothers and sisters in Christ here tonight would be blessed, and you would go with them as they go their separate ways. Keep us safe and bring us back to worship again on Sunday. We love you, and we ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen. God bless you all.